Well, the NBA season is finally upon us, and my guests this week are here to break it all down. We begin with Tim Bontemps, senior NBA writer for the Washington Post, who'll give us all the latest on the Warriors, the Rockets, everything going on with the NBA nationally. A little bit later on, I sit down with Steve Bulpet, the longtime Celtics beat writer over at the Boston Herald. We talk about Kyrie Irving's fit in Boston and just how long it will take a team with only four players returning to come together. All that and more next on the Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix.
This is the Vertical Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews,
let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news,
to insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road,
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
Joining me on the pod right now, Timmy Goodtimes, Tim Bontemps, senior writer, Washington Post. I feel like I am late to the game, Tim.
You're kind of late.
The Timmy Goodtimes.
You're about 15 years late.
Has that been going around the NBA?
You're very, very late.
I mean, I realized that after it started like a tweet storm when I was like, wow, that nickname's going to stick. When I saw Candace Buckner tweeted at you and
yeah,
everybody's like,
my last name means good times in French. So
does it really? This is amazing.
That's why it's been my nickname for a very long time.
I will never call you anything but Timmy Goodtimes from now on.
People have called me either that or Timmy GT for a long time.
Timmy GT doesn't flow. That feels like forced. Timmy Goodtimes. That's
one of the they're interchangeable. Either way, you're very late to the party as usual.
Oh, that's my MO too. Timmy Goodtimes joining me here on the Pod Taps. Fresh off a podcast today. Fresh off a flight from Oakland out here. We're recording this in Cleveland just before the opener of the Cavaliers and the Celtics. Before we get to the Cavs, I want to ask you about the Warriors and where they're at right now. Golden State brings back the core of the entire team. You can make a pretty decent argument that this team's better than what it was last year. Do you think they're better? And
definitively.
How so?
They have 12 of their 15 guys back, and the three guys they replaced, they all replaced with significantly better players. Omri Cassidy is much better than Matt Barnes. Nick Young is better than Ian Clark. And Jordan Bell, the rookie from Oregon, is far better than James Michael McAdoo, who Steve Kerr liked and would play occasionally, but was pretty terrible. And Jordan Bell looks like a guy who already might be their second or third best big. I think they're much better. They're going to have everybody back. They're all on the same page. They're very comfortable. I think that going into last year, it was clear the Warriors were going to win the title if they stayed healthy. This year, I mean, it's laughable to me how far they are ahead of the field. Even after all the moves that were made this summer, I don't think anybody's even within shouting distance of them.
Yeah, I mean, look, beating them 4 out of 7, I don't know how you do it. I don't know how anybody...
If they're healthy, you don't. You just don't.
Kind of depressing for the rest of the NBA.
It is and it isn't. I mean,
it's good for the NBA?
Well, I don't know if it's good, but the weird thing about this season for me...
16-1, good last year? I thought that was terrible.
I mean, the weird thing about this season for me is that the ending, I think, is a formality. The Cavs and Warriors will play again, and the Warriors will win. But there are a million things to watch all year. So, like, last year, I thought the regular season was one of the best regular seasons we've had in a very long time. I kind of feel like this year will be the same thing, whereas maybe the playoffs, particularly when the Warriors are involved, won't be as exciting as they normally are. But I think for the next 6 or 7 months, we're going to have a pretty awesome regular season with a lot of cool stuff to watch. So, I think for NBA fans, they might have to readjust their thinking a little bit for like how to follow the season and like get the most out of it. I think obviously from a competitive standpoint, you would like to see somebody be able to challenge the Warriors, but it's just hard to see. I mean, I went to Rockets practice yesterday before I flew out, and they're very confident. They think they can win 60 games. Mike D'Antoni said we should have won that many last year. We think we can do it this year. They feel good about the pairing of James Harden and Chris Paul. Like, they made some nice additions to improve their defense. Like, they should be really good, but you still watch them play Golden State and you just put the pieces out and you line them up, and you just don't see how they're going to be able to hold up against them.
You know, two things could derail Golden State. One's injuries, and you can't really predict that. The other is, internal strife. And, I think people wondered about the chemistry of the team this offseason when Kevin Durant, did what he did, went after Under Armour, took a shot at Steph Curry's brand, seemingly can't let go of of everything that happened
right.
in Oklahoma City. Has that completely blown over within the team, or is that something that could reemerge as a potential issue?
I don't know if it's completely blown over, but I think that with the people that are involved, it's not going to become a big thing. There is no coach better probably in the league at managing that kind of situation than Steve Kerr, even better than his mentor, Greg Popovich, just in terms of having a feel for the room and being able to kind of work that stuff out. And if there was any guy that was going to, you know, respond in some way without getting it into being a huge back and forth, it'd be Steph Curry. I mean, the combination of him and Kerr, I think, were able to diffuse that without too much of an issue. Curry, you know, got some, I wouldn't even say shots, but he kind of defended Under Armour earlier this preseason. But I don't think that any of that stuff in the end is really going to linger on. You know, I mean, I think, you know, that Warriors group, it's a pretty easygoing, lighthearted group, and Steve does a nice job of keeping them all pretty even keeled throughout the year. So I think they had a conversation and kind of smoothed things over, but I mean, I think it would take a lot more than that to me to really screw this team up at this point.
Do you think there's any part of Durant that regrets his decision to go to Golden State? Because I would, the way I look at it, I don't think there's regret. I do think that there's always going to be a part of him that wonders what if, that, you know, what would have happened if he had stayed? What would have happened if he had just been continually embraced by the city? I don't think he likes being disliked. I guess
no, he definitely doesn't like being disliked. And I mean, look, I think that Kevin Durant's in the same exact position LeBron was in after a year in Miami. And from when LeBron went to Miami with the decision and everybody hated him to the end of his 4 years in Miami, the whole narrative had changed. And I think the same thing's going to happen here. The Warriors are going to keep winning. That is going to wash away all this other stuff. And when you look back on this Warriors team, people aren't going to put asterisks on it. They're going to say this was one of the greatest teams of all time, and they steamrolled through the league. And Durant was, you know, a 1A part of that with Steph Curry. So, you know, I mean, it's not like people go back and say all the Celtics in the 60s were loaded. So, you know, it's not that big a deal that they won 11 out of 13 championships. You know, it's like they won 11 out of 13 championships. Same with the Bull. I mean, you could say the 90s, the quality of play wasn't quite as high. You had Michael and Scottie on the same team. They're two of the five best players in the league. They won six titles. It's not like anybody, you know, said, oh, you know, their titles don't count. You know, they won six titles. Even with the Heat, you know, people said, you know, people were saying that those titles are going to be, in the long run, they're going to not mean anything because Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh and LeBron teamed up and, you know, the league just wasn't fair anymore. And they won a couple championships, and all anybody remembers now is they won a couple championships. So I think in time, that's all people are going to think about is the success that Durant had there. And frankly, I think he's quite happy there. He likes being in the Bay Area. He likes doing this tech stuff, this other off-the-court stuff he's into, and he likes playing for the Warriors. I mean, you know, it's a fun team to play for. It's a real, like I said before, it's a real easygoing atmosphere, and they play a fun style of ball, and frankly, they're really good. And I think anybody who's played sports, like, you like to win, and they're all pretty friendly, and they're going to keep winning. So, you know, I think as long as that continues, I think everybody's going to be happy with it.
All right, so the Western Conference, those teams aren't just standing pat and giving it to Golden State. We've talked a lot over the last few weeks about where Oklahoma City's at, but you mentioned Houston, and I'm not concerned at all that James Harden and Chris Paul can play together. I mean, if it was any other coach but Mike D'Antoni, I might be.
Right.
But, I mean, the guy's an offensive genius. And
right.
He's going to figure out a way to make it work. Plus, Harden has to – at this point, Harden's got to welcome help, you know, at the way that last season ended with him just being a one-man band and seeing a wall of defenders lined up by San Antonio in that conference semifinals. But my question with the Rockets, as always, well, twofold. One – can they defend at a high enough level to be consistent? I mean, D'Antoni's always said, we've got to be a top 10 defensive team to
right.
make any kind of impact. I don't see that in Houston. And they have the front court depth they need to have with in terms of scoring to be able to balance out that back court. Do they need it, do you think?
Well, I mean, it was interesting. Like I said, I was at practice yesterday before I flew out, and it was interesting how often defense came up. I mean, it just came up over and over and
it's
over.
It's always
again.
Lip service, though. I mean, look, I'm not trying to disrespect. No. Mike does what he does, but well, and he's no, such but, a great offensive
well,
coach.
Well, but what I was going to say was it wasn't necessarily like I know where you're going with Mike, and it was more like whether it was from him and Harden and the different people who talked yesterday. It was they all the way I took it at least was they all understand that this is a unique situation. Right. And for them to beat Golden State, because obviously that's who they're playing tonight. We're recording this on Tuesday. Like, for them to beat Golden State in a series, like we were talking about, they have to do everything perfectly, basically. And I think the way I took what they were saying was, like, look, we know our offense is going to be awesome. If we're going to have any chance to play these guys, we have to stop. We have to get stops. We have to somehow. And I think, you know, between getting PJ Tucker and getting Luka Bamute, having Trevor Ariza, having Chris Paul there, having Clint Capella there, who I think is a really underrated guy in terms of you look around the league at guys who I think are going to be really important players in the league this year who people aren't talking about. I mean, Clint Capella might be at the top of that list. Like, if he can take a big leap and become an elite center, or at least an elite, you know, role to the rim and defensive center, that gives the Rockets another dimension that they don't really have now. So I'm with you. I'm skeptical they're going to actually play defense. I'm skeptical James Harden's going to try on defense. I'm frankly skeptical Chris Paul still has all that he's had in the past to still be an elite defender at the point. But I thought the moves they made this summer were pretty interesting in terms of the ways they can deploy their roster. Now they can play PJ Tucker at some small ball center, which is going to be interesting. And I think Mike is pretty creative about lineups. And I think with the amount of pieces Daryl Morey's given him, I think he does have the ability to put some pretty good defensive lineups out there with James Harden. And, you know, I think they're going to be really interesting to watch because they are the one team I feel like in the whole league, even maybe more than Cleveland, that if everything comes together, their offense has got the potential to be so nuclear that they could maybe hit 25 or 30 threes in two or three games and make a series really interesting with Golden State. So, you know, obviously tonight's game is just one game, but over the course of the year, I'm really interested to watch them because I think they've got the potential to be a pretty interesting team.
I'm with you on Capella. I like him. I don't think he's ever going to be a back-to-the-basket scorer, but he can run the floor.
DeAndre Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah.
If he can become DeAndre Jordan, and I think he can, that would be a big move for them.
Yeah, they'd take DeAndre Jordan.
For sure.
Mix. I think they're a conference semifinals team. That's probably their ceiling with that group. But you never know with Oklahoma City how they shake out. And San Antonio, that's the next team I wanted to kind of dive into. The news with the Spurs that they signed LaMarcus Aldridge to a contract extension, which I think is smart for both sides. You know, Aldridge hasn't...
Why?
Because Aldridge hasn't, even though he hasn't lived up to expectations coming in there, and there's clearly been... some friction between Aldridge and the coaching staff about his role, particularly offensively. I don't think they were going to be able to sign somebody else that would give them his production. At the same time, I don't think the market for Aldridge was out there either if he had free agency in his early 30s.
Right.
So I think bringing him back on that deal, maybe it doesn't elevate them to the championship level, but it at least gives them a second quality offensive option that they can lean on. Albeit one that certainly has some flaws.
Here's the part that I didn't understand. You mentioned the friction there. Everybody who's been around the league has known about this obvious tension.
And it was predictable, too, coming into
that. Yes. I don't think the Spurs really sold him a bill of goods. I think what happened was they expected him to come there and be the primary offensive guy, and then he got there, and Kawhi took another leap. Even beyond what they expected. And
you think they expected him to be the primary?
I think at least in the first season, like I'm sure LaMarcus was, they told LaMarcus, we want you to come here and be our number one option on offense. And I think they probably at the time believed that. I don't think anybody 2 years ago was thinking Kawhi was going to come in and average 26 points a game. To that point, I think he'd scored 30 points in a game once. Like, no, nobody thought, everybody thought he could get there, but people didn't think that LaMarcus was going to show up, and as he was going to show up, Kawhi was going to become this ultra-efficient 26, 27-point-a-game scorer at the same time. So I think they probably thought, okay, we'll have LaMarcus be the guy in year one, then start to transition in year two as Kawhi starts to grow into being that guy. Instead, Kawhi was ready to be that guy from day one, and LaMarcus immediately had to take a back seat. And then he was back in the same kind of position he was frustrated with in Portland with Dame Lillard. And then that led to, you know, 2 years of grumbling on both sides. And the part I don't understand is, I mean, your point is valid about they might not be able to get a better option than him. But look, the market for LaMarcus was not going to be great next summer. There's not a lot of teams with cap space. He almost certainly was going to have to opt into his contract for next year because he probably wasn't going to match that in the open market. So if you're the Spurs and you have LaMarcus locked up essentially for the next 2 years, to me, I don't understand why you would then extend it out to 4 years and sign him through his age 35 season. I just, it to me, if you look at what the Spurs have done over the last 4 months, if it was any other team in the league, they would have gotten completely obliterated by everybody. They signed Rudy Gay as their one primary free agent signing. Guy was coming off a torn Achilles. There's been no track record of anybody coming back.
Isn't he the most fascinating free agent signing, though? Like, if the Spurs were clamoring for him, and again, maybe it's just that it's the Spurs, but no, since but the Spurs were clamoring for him, that makes me wonder exactly how they're going to deploy
him. No, and I'm curious.
And he could be a four.
I'm curious for the same reason. I think he's going to be a four, too, and it could work out really well. But, that's the one signing they make, the guy that everybody, like, empirically has never really helped the team win. They get Pau Gasol to opt out, presumably to go after Chris Paul. Then they don't get a chance to go after Chris Paul. Then they not only give Pau the money back that he was going to get, they give him 2 more years. So he's signed till he's like 40, which doesn't make any sense.
Oh, they almost had. There probably had to be a handshake.
Well,
I know
there had to be something, but to me, it's like
Spurs
all right,
are famous for that. Richard
no,
Jefferson.
I know. I know that. But like, I thought the handshake was, I mean, I knew there was probably going to be a handshake deal. I thought the handshake deal was going to be, all right, we'll sign you for, you know, if we get somebody great, if not, we'll give you the money back and give you 1 more year. Instead, they gave him 2 more years. So you just go up and you just go down the list. And if it was just, hey, Team X did X, Y, and Z this summer, people go, that was a terrible summer. But it's the Spurs. So people are going to say, oh, yeah, Spurs are going to win 60 games. Well, okay, maybe, but their summer was weird. This contract extension, I am baffled by. And now you have Kawhi out indefinitely, has not done anything, does not seem, frankly, that close to coming back. I put out my predictions for the year. I didn't put them on any of my All-NBA teams, and people freaked out. But like at this point, I don't know how you can assume he's going to be back in a week. And if the guy misses a month, then it's going to be hard for him to make an All-NBA team. So I am utterly fascinated by them because, like I've made clear, I haven't really understood anything they've done this summer, which is weird. Usually the Spurs, you have a pretty good idea what they're doing. And I just don't know what their team is going to look like. Then they played the Rockets the other day without Kawhi. They won by 20. I mean, the Rockets yesterday were saying how great the Spurs look without Kawhi, and they think they're going to be fine. And I'm with you. I think they're going to drop down. One of my bold predictions for the season was the Spurs will be outside the top four in the West.
Wow.
I mean, I picked them to finish fifth, but still.
Who's ahead of them? Golden State?
Golden State, Houston, Oklahoma City, and Minnesota.
You've been bullish on it. You got to stop.
Well,
Minnesota.
I mean, Minnesota's pretty much roundly predicted to finish.
You had them like as a conference finalist last year.
Look, Minnesota. I did not have them that way. Minnesota's been pretty roundly projected to finish fifth. I just flip flopped them with the Spurs. I mean, look, I'm sure the Spurs are now going to win 58 games. LaMarcus probably averaged 22-10, and I look like an idiot because this is what the Spurs have done for 20 years. But I'm just to your point. I'm just very fascinated by them because I think they've had probably the most curious offseason to me on any team in the league, and you know they just find a way to make everything work, and I'm really curious to see if they do that this time.
Well, they need, I mean, to have that type of season, the second seed, third seed type of season, they need elevated performances from guys that you're not expecting to give you that at this point. Aldridge, is what he is, and at his age, he's not going to get, doesn't seem like he's going to get much better, and Tony Parker is a year older and is going to be out for at least a month or so with an injury. So they lose Jonathan Simmons too, which is not to be overlooked since he was a big part of what they did.
Right. Didn't really replace him.
Didn't really replace him there either. So they need guys, Kyle Anderson. I mean, there's a whole bunch of guys they need to step up and play bigger roles. But, you know, doubting them has become almost stupid. Like, if the Spurs like Rudy Gay, then Rudy Gay must be. Rudy Gay's going to average 15 from the stretch four.
Right.
If they sign Aldridge back, Aldridge is all of a sudden going to sing Kumbaya with Pop and everything's going to be.
Yeah, I mean, they've been great for 20 years, so they'll probably make me look stupid.
Yeah.
But
they'll make
we'll
all
see.
Of us look stupid.
Yes.
All right, let's talk about Cleveland and where they're at right now as a team. I've been out here for the last few days going to practice and talking to a whole bunch of people in the organization. And, you know, look, it's Derrick Rose. He could be a good addition to this team. He's lost weight. He's done all that. Kevin Love at the five, floor spacing type of team. But ultimately, is this? Do we have any idea what this team is until Isaiah Thomas comes back? I mean, they are, whatever they are right now and whatever they are 2 months from now, they are a completely different team when Isaiah Thomas comes back. Isaiah was a top five, not just top five MVP, but he was top five usage rate in the league. So incorporating him, I'm not sure how it works, but I know that this team is going to look markedly different when he gets back into the mix.
Yeah, I don't really think it matters whether Isaiah Thomas plays this year or not.
Okay. Timmy Goodtime spent too much time on the West Coast there.
I don't. No, honestly, I don't really think that. That's not really a knock on Isaiah. It's more just that, to me, if Cleveland has good health otherwise, right, I think their path is fairly straightforward either way. I think if Isaiah doesn't come back, I still think they're better than Boston. I still think they make the finals. I still think they get killed by the Warriors.
If Isaiah doesn't come back, they're not better than Boston. They're not.
I mean, think they are.
That's too much faith in Derrick Rose. And look, I like how he's looked, but...
It's got nothing to me. You know my stance on Derrick Rose. That has nothing to do with Derrick Rose. I just think that they can deploy lineups where they can have LeBron surrounded by shooting and defensive players against a team like Boston in a playoff series where Derrick Rose isn't going to be a factor anyway. I mean, they're not going to need...
I mean, look, if it's Derrick Rose and Jose Calderon, how do you defend anybody?
That's what I'm saying. If Isaiah isn't in the mix, okay, if they're in a playoff series, they don't need to play Derrick Rose. LeBron will have the ball in his hands all the time anyway. They could take Derrick Rose out. They could put J.R. Smith in. And then you can have long, athletic shooters all around LeBron and just have LeBron run the point, and they'll be able to defend, and they'll be fine. And they'll still, by the way, have LeBron on their team. To me, it's not – this isn't a knock on Isaiah. I just think the way – like, if he comes back, obviously there's going to be an adjustment period to try to figure things out. And I know he's already been doing some shooting. Hopefully for his sake, he comes back. He had an awesome year last year. He's a easy guy to root for. He's in line to hopefully get paid next summer in a way he never really has before. So hopefully he can come back and be healthy and be good. I just think, you know, this Boston team, you know, I know you talked about them with Steve. This Boston team, I just think they're going to have a lot of stuff to sort out. I'm not even 100% sure they're going to make the conference finals. You know, they've got to integrate all these new pieces. I'm not convinced Kyrie. I mean, the Celtics were as good as they were last year because Isaiah Thomas had an unbelievable season. Like, to your point, he was incredibly efficient. He had an incredibly high usage rate. He hit a million clutch shots. Kyrie Irving is more talented than Isaiah Thomas. He's never had a year anything close to what Isaiah did. So can he match that? Can they make up for all the depth that they lost? Yes, getting Gordon Hayward and Kyrie Irving, you do that every time. They're going to start essentially two rookies tonight against the Cavs. They don't really have a lot of big depth. Marcus Morris is out. They really only have two true bigs on the team. Their second unit, you know, like, they're going to rely a lot on a guy like Terry Rozier. How is he going to do? Is Marcus Smart going to actually hit shots this year? And I know he's thin Marcus Smart now is hitting shots in the preseason, but let's see if
contract
that carries.
Contract year, baby.
Contract year. You know, he didn't sign an extension, so maybe he'll blow up and be really good. I know some people around the league think he can do that. But to me, they just have a lot of questions. And, you know, if you're looking at Boston or Washington, I think that clearly the two best teams besides Cleveland. You know, as constructed right now, I think either one of those teams in a conference finals, even if Isaiah isn't in the mix, still would lose to Cleveland in the end. So I do think there would be an adjustment period. Obviously, the Cavs would have to try to figure out a way to work in Isaiah. I do think that if Isaiah does come back, it will obviously help, because then whether he has the ball in his hands or not, he's a far superior option to Rose, who can't shoot and can't defend either. So, you know, he'll clearly help. But at this point, just the way I've looked at it from the beginning is it's just found money with them. Like, if they get Isaiah to come back, great. But if they don't, I still don't think it ultimately changes Cleveland's destiny.
I'm glad you said that, because I – 100% disagree and take a completely different position because...
Of course you do.
Well, look, Cleveland was the best team in the Eastern Conference last year. And look, I can buy the theory that Boston could lose before the conference finals. I think Washington's going to be a little
bit... I actually
think
they're going to lose to Washington.
Maybe. I think Washington's a little bit better. I think Otto Porter, I was down there recently, a lot more relaxed as a player since the new contract.
I've heard a lot of good things about Otto in the preseason.
And Scott Brooks, I think, is going to have a better handle of how to manage that team in his second full season. At the same time, last year, if Kyrie Irving doesn't lose his mind in Game 4 of the conference finals, Boston evens that series against Cleveland, heading back home with two of the next three at the Garden. Now, we can sit here and agree. I think Cleveland still would have won that series anyway. But without Isaiah Thomas, they almost won two games from the Cavaliers. They needed Kyrie Irving to go postal in Game 4 of that series to pull it out. I think without Isaiah Thomas, this team in Cleveland, third best team maybe in the conference. Maybe even fourth best team in the conference. That's how much I think they need, especially come playoff time I'm speaking of mostly. Like, I just think Kyrie was that much of an offensive weapon for them in the playoffs that if you don't have him, the combination of Rose and Wade and Jay Crowder, it just doesn't equal what Kyrie Irving gave them. Isaiah can, though. I think Isaiah's capable of it.
Those are some ballsy comments.
Well, look,
fourth best team in the East?
In the playoffs,
They still have LeBron on their team, boss.
Still LeBron, great player, and they now have a shooting front court they didn't have last year. Everyone in that front court in the starting lineup
right.
is a 36-plus percent three-point shooter. Right. They're going to be weapons.
I
think you're just underestimating what Kyrie was doing for them last year.
Well, no. Kyrie is a very good offensive player who's a horrendous defensive player. And who I think that you can make up for through I think they can make up for him with the combination of lineups that give them better defensive flexibility and just having the ball even more in LeBron's hands surrounded by better shooting. One guy who last year was horrendous was J.R. Smith. Like, you go back and look, J.R. shot 34% from the season overall, shot 35% from three, but like, was horrendous last year. He came into camp. He had the knee issue last year and the contract stuff. And like, he never looked right. So I know he right now is miffed about not starting, but if they can get 2 years ago version of JR and they get Jay Crowder, they have Kevin Love now starting with LeBron. They're playing LeBron more at the four now. Like, they have a lot of ways to, They have a lot more lineup versatility and depth now.
Absolutely.
That they didn't have before. So I am not dismissing what Kyrie did, and I'm not dismissing what Isaiah can do. It's more just that it's a very different Cleveland team. I guess just at the end of the day, I trust LeBron to be able to, you know, figure out a way to make that work. Because
it's been
8 years since he has.
But you know that already, and maybe we see it in the first week of the season, already teams have to be scheming of finding ways to use their guards to double down and put another defender on LeBron James, to set another guy at least in his direction.
Right.
Because unless Dwayne Wade and Derrick Rose prove that they can consistently knock down three-point shots, why wouldn't you... you know, send both their defenders at this guy.
Oh, yeah. No, listen, we are in agreement that the Derrick Rose, Dwayne Wade backcourt is a complete dumpster fire. I mean, that's just a disaster. I mean, having those two guys starting together is terrible.
You got to have shooting, and I don't think they give you enough three-point shooting.
You have to have shooting. You have to have shooting. But, you know, I also don't think that when the rubber hits the road in the playoffs – If the Cavs are in a situation where they need to win games, that's not going to be their starting backcourt. And whether that's because Isaiah's healthy or whether it's because they just say, Derek, go sit on the bench, because I imagine Dwayne Wade will start because he's LeBron's guy, they're not going to just roll that out there for playoff games, I don't think. I mean, look, if they don't change anything in the playoffs and they're just rolling out Derrick Rose and Dwayne Wade in the conference finals and it's not working and they keep doing it, well, yeah, maybe then it won't work. But, I mean, I think you already can kind of see from what the Cavs are saying about, you know, how they're going to use Rose, they're going to sub him out quick. Like, you know, who knows with the internal dynamics of the team, like why they have to do things the way they do now. But I think when you're in a playoff series and you have to make lineup decisions, to me, I just think if you roll out LeBron with, you know, J.R. Smith and Jay Crowder and Kevin Love and Tristan, and you just run pick and rolls with LeBron and Tristan, and you have those other three guys spaced out around the perimeter, I just think they're going to be really tough to guard, and they're still going to be able to do a lot of stuff defensively. You're going to be able to switch a lot, and I think that lineup in particular is going to be really good. So I think they'll find a way to get it done. But look, LeBron, this ankle issue, we're still not 100% sure he's going to play, though I'm sure he's going to, but maybe this is the year he starts to get some nagging injuries a little bit. And maybe, you know, Kevin Love has had some injuries in the past. Maybe Kevin Love gets banged up. Or maybe JR doesn't play. Maybe JR's just kind of shot. And he's like, last year is what he is now. I mean, you can paint a picture where the Cavs do just take a step back. And, you know, maybe they can't figure it out. Or, you know, do the Wizards make a Boogie Cousins trade? Or do the Celtics go get somebody else? Like, there are paths, but I think as it stands now, if the main teams involved all stay put, I just trust LeBron to get it done in the end.
All right, let me get you out of here at this before you stuff your face with Starbucks too many times.
Gotta eat some food, man.
Exactly. You mentioned a Boogie Cousins trade or Boston maybe doing something.
Yeah.
Give me a player you're keeping your eye on for midseason.
Boogie Cousins.
You think that New Orleans could move him?
I am very concerned about New Orleans. I don't know.
I would be too.
It's a preseason game, I will granted, but on Friday, Memphis played New Orleans. The final score was 142 to 101. The Grizzlies won. All the main contributors played on both sides.
Oh, Rondo's out.
Rondo, okay.
And that hurt. No, that really hurts them, though. At least offensively. Defensively, maybe not. Offensively.
I mean, it does and it doesn't. They still have Drew Holiday, Anthony Davis, and DeMarcus Cousins, who all played and were all like minus 15 or worse in 15 minutes. If that team goes off a cliff, which it might, like, that's a rough situation. I mean, they don't have a lot of depth. They always have injury issues. Anthony's constantly leaving games with something. I mean, if he or Drew misses any time, or if DeMarcus misses any time, they're going to be in rough shape. So if that team is, I don't know, if you're in mid-January and that team is 15-25 or 17-23, and they're not going to make the playoffs, I think you have to look at trading DeMarcus to get something for him. I mean, you got him for a first-round pick in Buddy Hield. I mean, you basically got a free flyer on him.
And then what does that mean you're going to get for him, though? With a year and a half left in his contract, it was Buddy Hield.
Well, I mean, look, for example, from the Wizards, if you go to the Wizards and say, hey, give us Otto Porter, we'll take Ortat, give us a first-round pick, take back Omer Asik and DeMarcus. You get off the Asik money. You get a solid starting center in Gortat for a couple of years to play next to Anthony. You get Otto Porter, who's the vastly better wing than anybody they have.
Why do the Wizards do that?
Why would the Wizards do that?
Yeah.
Because you can pair DeMarcus Cousins with Brad Beal and John Wall, and you have, in my opinion, maybe three of the five best players in the Eastern Conference all on one team. Definitely three of the top 10. Probably not three of the top five, but definitely three of the top 10, probably three of the top seven or eight guys in the conference on a team. I think that might be the best team in the East then. I mean, you put that, that's a pretty deadly trio.
If it works. And, you know, I need to see Cousins.
If I agree with you, I think.
I saw them play in Oklahoma City as well, and Cousins was the same guy.
I think
the maturity that gets talked about a lot just didn't see it.
Here's my thing. If I'm Washington, this is the first time that team's been relevant in at least a decade since the Gilbert days, right? You have a team that hasn't made the conference finals in 40 years, hasn't won 50 games in 40 years. You have John Wall and Bradley Beal, two of the 10 best players in the East, all-star backcourt, probably third best backcourt in the league behind Houston and Golden State, and maybe in a year, maybe better than Houston if Chris Paul takes a dip. So you've got elite guards, but you don't have the third guy. And to be a finals team, they need the third guy. And, you know, you're probably going to have to take some kind of risk to do that. You're not going to have cap space because you're capped out.
So you're going to have to roll the dice. And in my opinion, if there's any team in the league that should be willing to roll the dice on DeMarcus Cousins, it's the Wizards, because they've got the one guy in the league on their team who is he's going to listen to. You know, DeMarcus and John want to play together. They have a, you know, they obviously play together in Kentucky. And if there's anybody that's going to be able to go to DeMarcus and say, "Hey, you go over there, or you need to, you know, get your butt back on defense, or do this or do that," John Wall is going to tell him, and he's going to listen. So, you know, yeah, the Wizards have, I think, a really nice team. They can have a nice run the next few years. They got John Wall locked in with the designated player exception. They can have, you know, they could be a 48 to 52 win team for 3 or 4 years and be good. But when you have those guys locked in, to me, now is the time that, okay, if there's a guy like that that comes on the market that's a top 15 player in the league that we can get and that will want to stay and re-sign with our team, I think that if the opportunity presents itself in New Orleans is the mess that we think they can be, I just think if you're the Wizards, you have to take that swing because, I mean, to me, what's the alternative? Like just being pretty good? You can just be pretty good for a while, but if you have the chance to be great and make the finals... And, like, think about it. If they get DeMarcus, like, there's no reason to think they couldn't be the best team in the East for a couple of years. Or at the very worst, it's them in Boston. I mean, if LeBron does leave or if, like, this Cleveland situation doesn't really pan out, you look around the East, like, the Sixers are a huge question mark. The Bucks don't have anybody with Giannis. Like, there's the real potential there for these two teams with, you know, obviously the Celtics have a young core. The Wizards would have a pretty young core. Then they have three guys all in their mid-20s. You know, you could be looking at the two best teams in the East for a while.
It's a roll of the dice. And the only reason I think it would make sense for Washington is because you're right. They can't get better organically. They're capped out. I mean, they have three guys on max level deals.
And those guys are going to get better. And I think Otto's going to be good and he'll continue to get better, but he's never going to be that level of player.
Right. I could see that as a roll of the dice. Let me throw one name at you here.
Sure.
Marc Gasol. And I've kind of floated this in the past.
Yes.
But if you're Memphis, and look, you're probably not going to get a lot for Marc Gasol in his early to mid-30s at this point.
I don't know.
Or not a ton. Let's just.
I still think they might get a pretty good amount.
Okay, well, in that case, you absolutely have to move him. I mean, Memphis, what are they at best? 7 seed? 6 seed? Tops in the Western Conference? And that's charitable at this point.
No, I mean, I think he's a really interesting name, and he's one to pay attention to. And I think if things go south in Memphis... if they struggle, you know, Chandler Parsons is not looking like he's ever going to be what they thought he was going to be. They hope he could be a rotation player. That even seems to be in question. You know, they're another team, very thin. You know, they just released Wade Baldwin yesterday, their first-round pick last year. They haven't had a second
whiff on first-round picks.
They haven't
like
had
that.
A second contract for a first-round pick in 10 years since Mike Conley signed.
Yep. That is what kills you every single time.
You go back and look. They drafted Jordan Adams one spot ahead of Rodney Hood. You go back, there was a couple other guys that could have got that they didn't get. They don't have any of those depth guys around their core now. And you're right. I think that if you look at Memphis and – you know, their picks are tied up. I think Boston has their pick in 19, right?
19, yeah.
So, you know, and look, I think that Boston makes sense for them. You know, they've still got a bunch of assets. Boston, I know Danny Ainge in the past has liked Marc Gasol. You could play him and Horford
hard
together.
Hard to make the money work, though. That's the problem. I mean, Boston can't. You'd have to almost deal Horford to
you
get
might,
Gasol
but,
there.
But, I mean, that's... you know, there's – we'll see. But – to your point, though, regardless of whether that's a good fit or not, if they do struggle, I think you could see that situation get blown up because at some point, you know, like if it starts to go bad this year, you look around the West, obviously you've got the teams at the top that are always good. And then you've got, you know, the Lakers are going to be coming. You know, the Mavericks are going to start getting better. Phoenix and Sacramento both could eventually start getting better. They all have young cores in place. Memphis has no young players. They just have those two guys, you know, and even like Portland and Denver, like all those teams in the mix with them, or Utah, like all those teams have younger guys that can grow more, whereas Mark's 32, 33, Mike Conley's 30, 31, like that they're aging out. So to your point, if they're struggling and they can cash one of those guys in, especially since Mark's got a couple years left at a decent rate, I think they have to look at it.
If Marc Gasol is healthy in January and he's playing like the Marc Gasol we're used to seeing, there needs to be an auction. like do a public auction in Memphis.
It's tough.
You have to make tough calls, Tim. Like, this guy is woven into the fabric of the community. He was there since high school.
No, I know.
When his brother was there. It's not easy to move a guy like that, but I agree with everything you said on where they are. They're not a contender. They're not going to be a contender. They're not hitting on these draft picks.
Right.
You need to get his value depreciates every single month. You get past February, his value goes down. You went to the following season, his value goes down. You have to hold an auction for him, I think, sometime in January.
Well, I think it comes down to where they're at in the standings, right? Because if they're in the mix, like,
what does in the mix mean, though?
No, I mean if they have a legit shot to be in the playoffs,
is that even a good thing though? Like, that's the whole
look.
Like, that
but you're not. I know, but like, it's the same thing with New Orleans, right? Like, these teams are not going to completely punt on a chance to make the playoffs. But I think if there is any kind of slippage, and there's an injury or the rest of the roster's decimated, and they get themselves in a hole, I think that those two teams in particular, both are going to have to look long and hard at that, because if you're at least hanging around the playoff picture, you're right. Like, cold, hard, just cold look at it from the outside, you should just blow it up. But it's going to be hard for them to do that, with the chance to make some playoff money, to be in the mix all season, to have their arena full. Like, that's a small market. They obviously... Yep. They need, like, if they're still competitive, they got to ride that out as long as they can. But, you know, it probably long term for the franchise would work out for them if they do get off to a bad start and blow it up, because then they could do that. But you just never see teams say, you know what, we have a chance to make the playoffs, but we're going to trade our franchise icon now.
Boston did it. I mean, they did.
I mean,
it would have been a playoff team, a top four team probably, with Rondo, KG, and Pierce, but they weren't going anywhere. They were getting beat in the first and second round.
Well,
I know it's different because the market size, they make more money.
Listen.
How is that different?
Because they traded Pierce. You're talking about when they traded him to Brooklyn?
Yeah.
I mean, Pierce and Garnett were in their late 30s. And
it was mid-30s for Pierce at that point. They were probably a little older than Gasol, but not by much, I think.
I mean, they were significantly older than Gasol.
Well, Gasol's what, 33? That was 4 years ago?
I mean, they were in a position where they to me, I mean, that's a fair point, except they didn't make that trade mid-season either.
Right. Hey, you want to trade Mark now? I mean... If you can find
it. Well, that's what I mean. Like, I think if you make that trade at the draft, like the Celtics did, like if they make a trade at the draft next year and trade Mark, or if they'd made a trade at this past draft, that's much different than saying we're in January, the Grizzlies are a game out of a playoff spot, or a game, say they're in seventh, a game up on ninth, and they punt. Like, that's a far different thing than, hey, we just lost in the first round to the Knicks, and we struggled. We almost got swept, and then we won a couple games, and our guys are at the end of the line, and we can get 5 first-round picks for them, so let's trade them.
Yeah.
You know, that's different than we're in January, we have an okay team, we're in the mix for a playoff spot, and we're going to punt on the season.
If I'm a fan, though, like, making the playoffs, it does nothing for me. A real fan knows what your team is. Like, if you're a real fan, do you care about going to the playoffs and getting beat in 5 games? Like,
I think it does.
Money wise, I know it does.
I think it does to a lot of fans. I also think that it's just very hard to, it's very hard to be midway through a season and just quit. You just don't see that. You don't see teams quit when they have a chance, because people are competitive and making the playoffs matters to people. You know, I mean. Teams like Minnesota would give an arm to make the playoffs. They made the playoffs in 13 years. Mm-hmm. Kings haven't made the playoffs in 10 years. Suns haven't made the playoffs now in, what, 6-7 years? Like, if you stop making the playoffs, you can miss the playoffs for a long time. So I'm with you. Like, logically, they should hold an auction today. And just, like, if you were playing 2K, you'd be like, all right, I got to trade Marc Gasol. I got to trade Mike Conley. I got to get a bunch of draft picks. Start over. But it's hard in reality, it's hard to make that kind of a trade
and blow your team up if you have a shot. That's like I said, I think you're spot on that that's the other team to really look at. But to me, they're only going to make a move like that if they're completely out of the mix. And then they just decide to start over. And it just reminded me, the one other team that would be curious about that too is Detroit. I'm going to see them tomorrow. They're also, I think, going to be really interesting at a real crossroads, I think, as an organization. And if things are not looking good this year, I think you could see anybody get traded.
Yeah.
You know, especially, you know, Andre Drummond is probably the biggest name there.
They kicked the tires on everybody last year.
Yeah.
And I think if
they struggle this year, they might do a lot more than kick the tires. You know, I could see them really trying to alter that team. I think they're going to be pretty good, actually, and kind of surprise people a little bit, because I think a lot of the stuff that happened last year was, you know, BC boy Reggie Jackson just never – another guy who was never right after a knee injury. And he looks pretty good in the preseason. If he can be healthy and they can get that pick and roll running again with him and Andre, I think a lot of the stuff that was going on last year will start to, you know, fizzle out and they'll look better. But if it doesn't, that's another team that I think you could look at. It's kind of in the same boat. Like, you're not sure where they're going. And if they decide they need to blow things up, I mean – Drummond has his faults, but he's still a young big who's athletic and huge that, you know, I could see some team wanting to take a chance on to, try to think they could get some more out of him.
A conversation for another podcast.
There you go.
Timmy Goodtimes, thanks for joining me. Go stuff your face and write some copy, all right?
Sure, buddy.
Thanks, man. My thanks to Tim Bontemps. Before we get to Steve Bulpet, I want to tell my listeners about a great new deal over at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Support for the Vertical Podcast comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Mannix, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030. Joining me on the podcast now, he's beginning his 66th year on the Celtics beat. He does a great job covering the Celtics.
For my next trick, human sacrifice. Say goodbye to Chris Mannix.
Steve Bulpet covers the Celtics for the Herald. How many years is this for you, Steve?
This will be 33.
Wow.
When you started, I started when I was four.
when you started covering the beat, did you want to do it as long as you've wound up doing it?
I had no clue. Still have no clue. It's something that just seemed to fit. I had opportunities to go elsewhere, and to even at my paper, they wanted me to be a general sports columnist at one point. But I just kind of liked the NBA community. The referees, the people you see on the road, you know, you run into the occasional smart ass kid, like, I don't know, a Chris Mannix.
You got two generations of Mannixes. That you work with.
I'm not sure I can call you a kid anymore, but no, it's seriously, it's a, you know the deal. It's a good group, good community to deal with, year in and year out. And it can be kind of hard to leave that at a certain point.
Yeah, no question. So this is I don't know how you describe this team right now. It's an interesting team, to say the least. Explosive team. How would you describe a team that, you know, just for context, a 53-win team, brought four guys back, completely overhauled the roster. Right now, with the preseason in the books, how do you see Boston?
I see them as a team you're really not going to want to judge, or will not be able to judge appropriately, until February, March, maybe. Not only do the veteran guys, their quote-unquote stars, have to get their groove together, but you've also got so many young people who have never played an NBA minute who are going to be in the rotation or going to be getting opportunities at different times. So I think it's going to be a long haul for this group. The thing I would say that, you know, I would give the Celtics credit for is that, you know, 53 wins, conference finals appearance, that was pyrite. they knew that they could not compete with Cleveland. And I think, you know, it would have been easy to just to, you know, heck, add a Gordon Hayward. That's a big step forward for you right there. But understanding that they still weren't where they needed to be and recognizing that fact and being willing to make, bigger deals.
Are they a better team?
I think so. I mean, hey, look, last year they got by because they had really good character guys who worked their butts off all regular season long. And you've seen, we've all seen over the years, teams that, you know, they pick their spots. They would come out flat a lot. And I guess a lot of that is on Isaiah Thomas because he was, you know, such a lunatic that he wanted it every night. He would play just as hard on a Tuesday in February as he did on a Saturday night in May. You know, he was that kind of guy. And when you have people like that on your team, guys who maybe weren't drafted all that high, even a guy like a Jay Crowder, they're going to put in the work, and it will shame other people into working really hard, even if they weren't already predisposed to that.
You feel for Isaiah Thomas in the aftermath of that deal, but if you're Boston, you had to make that deal.
Yeah.
Times out of 10.
Put it this way here. Isaiah calls himself a real killer, and I think that if Isaiah were the general manager and he looked at the situation, he'd make the deal too. Let's just look at the physics of it. You're getting a guy 3 years younger, 6 inches taller, and that's before we even get into the relative merits of where Kyrie Irving and Isaiah Thomas are simply as basketball players.
Yeah, and, you know, look, Isaiah, the contract situation can't be overlooked either, because even if Isaiah was healthy, there were people in the organization that were wary of the whole Brinks truck stuff and how much they'd be willing to pay him. I mean, if he was looking for a 5-year max deal, that wasn't coming.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Celtics were going to pay him a max, and I wrote that, I think, pretty early on. I think the Brinks truck thing, I don't think that necessarily bothered people, because that was part of Isaiah. That was part of that, you know, he was going to put it out there, and then, you know, I'm going to set myself a goal and I'm going to match it. I also think that the Celtics didn't necessarily believe that other teams were going to give him a max either. So I thought that once they believed that, you know, had he stayed, once they got through that first round of posturing or whatever, that they would be able to come in at a number. But I think they were a little bit wary about that whole process and how it would play out.
I always thought that the summer of 2016 was an aberration for everybody. There was 5-year deals doled out like they were candy. This past summer, I think, would have been more of an indicator of what Isaiah's worth will be, and probably will be if he's healthy coming back. And the Kyle Lowry 3-year, $100 million type of deal, Paul Millsap, same type of range, even though the third year is a team option. Like he might be able to achieve the $30 million per year salary he's craving, but it's only going to be over a few years, and that's best case scenario if he comes back healthy.
I would strongly agree with that, but it only takes one team, and that's the wild card in this. I mean, we're sitting here now at whatever 11 o'clock, and we're looking at the Celtics. Are they going to be able to get an extension done with Marcus Smart? And if they don't, then what happens next summer? I mean, the market for Marcus Smart should be a reasonable thing that the Celtics could match, as if, you know, letting him become a restricted free agent. But what if one team, you know, just kind of breaks from the pack and gives him something crazy?
I do what Boston's doing, though. I mean, Marcus looks like he's in great shape this year. Mm-hmm. Looks like he's going to be able to step into that Avery Bradley role and play a lot of minutes for this team. But the way that the financial landscape shapes up next summer, there's not a lot of teams with great flexibility. How many teams will be willing to go out there and spend all their capital on a Marcus Smart? I mean, look, the Gary Harris deal has to be a little scary. I don't think I'd go Gary Harris territory, but, you know, Norman Powell in that range, the $10, $11 million per year, that is probably what Boston's looking at and what they would clearly match.
But if you're the Celtics, you're going to be capped anyway.
Yeah.
So you're not looking at, you know, trying to save space here. All you're kind of flirting with is maybe some luxury tax. And I think that for the Celtics, Marcus Smart is an important player, because what he gives you defensively off the bench, we're talking about, you know, just like we mentioned before, people who kind of shame other people into playing hard as well. He's that kind of guy. When Avery Bradley, when Doc Rivers finally started giving Avery Bradley minutes, the Celtics team that he started playing with there, the older Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce and Ray Allen, those guys weren't all that excited about getting back on defense and digging in necessarily. And a guy like Avery Bradley kind of shamed him into doing it a little bit. And I think Marcus Smart's that kind of guy that comes in and just turns up the tempo. You know, he may be Nolan Ryan with a fastball that, you know, goes off the backstop occasionally, but he's going to give you that thing. And I think that's an important element for the Celtics, and they really can't afford to lose that over a few luxury tax dollars.
You know, my theory on Marcus Smart, though, is if I'm him, I don't want to be in Boston beyond this coming season, just because I think there's a 30-minute-per-game point guard in him. I really do. And mm-hmm. he's never going to be that guy with the Celtics. It's going to be Kyrie Irving's team probably for the next 10 years. And look, if he's fine in that Avery Bradley quasi two-guard role, maybe playing point mm-hmm. when Kyrie goes to the bench, okay. But maybe it's just the spurts I've seen in him, Steve, but I've seen flashes. That game, what was it, 3 in Cleveland? Flashes of a guy that could play consistent point guard minutes. He's never going to get that chance in Boston.
It was funny you bring that up, because that's what I was thinking in my head. The intriguing part about Marcus Smart to me is that he's a guy that you counted on last year to make really good hustle plays, and you could also be pretty sure he's going to make a couple of mind-bending mistakes, you know, in each appearance. But then that game that he had to, you know, play, you know, when Isaiah gets out, and all of a sudden he played this under control game. And he said afterwards, well, it was because I had to. And it's like, wow, it's that easy for you. Just you had that in you, and it was that easy, just to having that responsibility made you do that. Yeah. But obviously we're going to need to see that a lot more before we really buy into it entirely. But, yeah, I could see him wanting to leave perhaps. But
do you think there's a good situation point guard in him?
I don't think I'd need more evidence, I guess. That's all. You know, I'd look and say, you know, I want to see that more often. But what I do see is a guy that is incredibly valuable, particularly to a team like the Celtics, that you've got a pretty solid starting five once you, you know, work out the fringes, you know, next to Horford and Irving and Hayward. But, you know, you're going to need to have that rotation get deeper, because against the better teams, you're going to hope that your starting five holds the fort and can match them. And then you really are going to want your bench guys to perhaps be the difference and put you over the top in situations.
So this team on paper looks like the most potent offensive team in the conference. I mean, they're the perimeter weapons that they have. I can't think of a team that's stronger in that regard. How long do you think it's going to be? You mentioned a few months for the team, but like guys like Irving and Hayward, the two alphas that are going to be scoring the ball, from what you've seen, their chemistry, how long is it going to take for those two to get on the same page?
I think their biggest issue for the first, you know, I'd expect several weeks, will be overpassing. I think Kyrie wants to show that he's not just this, you know, I want the control, I want the ball kind of guy. And I think we've seen a couple of instances where they've been kind of telling him, hey, you know, remember, you are, in fact, Kyrie Irving, and we do want you to take the ball and go when the opportunity presents itself. So, you know, I think that could be a bit. And you've got guys, I mean, Gordon Hayward isn't going to blanch at, you know, at Kyrie Irving taking and going. He's going to he's a willing passer as well. And certainly Al Horford, sometimes to his own detriment, is a willing passer.
Yeah. Horford's going to help, and Hayward, I think, is going to get a lot of touches in the post. I've said that before. I think he's a weapon down there. But Kyrie as the alpha now. I mean, look, he played in a lot of pressure situations in Cleveland. He made a lot of big shots in big moments, but it's never really been his team. It's been LeBron's team mm-hmm. throughout this process. Now in Boston, I know there's Hayward's there, Horford's there, but this is Kyrie's team now. It's his team. How do you think is he equipped to handle that? And what do you think is going to be his biggest challenges playing in the Boston market?
I think he's a very bright guy, first of all. So I from that, I'd say I think he's learned from LeBron James over the last few years, the good and the bad. The good being, you know, this is what you have to be every night. You have to be available and accountable. What Kyrie has to understand is that he has the ability to control the narrative now. After a good game, he can spread the praise around. Hey, you know, so-and-so was setting really good picks out there. We don't talk about him because his numbers maybe not show. But and he also has to accept the blame and smooth things over if they hit a rough patch. He has to be that out front guy, and it's an every night thing. But I also think he's, you know, so whereas LeBron was out there available every night, I do think he can probably look at some of the things LeBron did, like, you know, maybe not taking care of teammates enough post game. You know, J.R. Smith has a bad shooting game in the finals, and, you know, LeBron kind of shrugs, where he probably should have said, hey, I want him to take twice as many shots next game because he's going to hit him. Something like that would have been, you know, certainly J.R. Smith is, you know, those guys are listening to that stuff. They're reading all that stuff. You have the opportunity to, you know, do things in a positive way as well. So we'll see how much he's learned from LeBron, both the good and the bad.
Does his game need to evolve in Boston? Does it need to change from what it was in Cleveland?
Well, it has to change from what it was the last few years, right? Because, you know, he was kind of, he could play off the ball a lot more. He could, you know, fill into spots because you've got LeBron kind of being a vacuum to take, you know, to suck in the defense. I think he's going to be more of a distributor. I think he wants to be, he said he wants to be that. So here's the opportunity.
You know, when the draft happened, Steve, I was one of the people that, I didn't kill Danny for making the deal that he did, but I did say that, you know, Markelle Fultz, if he turns out to be a superstar, it's going to be a line on Danny's resume right at the top. Well, we're into October, and, you know, no conclusions can be drawn here, but Jason Tatum looks like he can play, whereas Markelle Fultz is having a hard time right now in Philadelphia. I guess, you know, without looking at Tatum necessarily, what have you seen from Tatum early on? I mean, do you hear the praise lavished on him, the Paul Pierce comparisons with the footwork? What do you see in him?
Well, the things I like about him, you can look at his skill set, which is, you know, pretty well evident. What I like about him is his competitiveness. You know, at different spots of games, he's not, I mentioned this the other day in a column, it's just, he's not just doing mechanically the things that need to be done. He's going after the ball. He's playing instinctively. You know, he's like a guy in the park trying to keep the court. And I think that competitiveness goes a long, long way in the NBA, in any sport, really. But, and if you look at bringing it back to Fultz, that was one of the questions about him was, you know, how engaged was he? You know, I hear from a lot of guys, a lot of scouts will go out to see him in college and saying, just, I don't know, you know, if he's not excited about playing this much now, what's it going to be like when he's going to play 82 regular season games? But then again, I heard, you know, another scout that I really trust say, hey, he hasn't played a ton of basketball yet. He doesn't understand it yet, but he's a good kid and he'll get it. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I just think right now, the way that Jason Tatum, the way he approaches the game, his makeup, his basketball makeup, puts him a little bit ahead of what you would expect a 19-year-old kid to be, my Lord, at this stage.
All right, let me finish with this. Are there expectations for this team this year? I mean, the overhauled roster, the fact that Cleveland is still kind of out there, is this Goliath at least for one more season? Is this almost a kind of a gimme type of season for Boston where whatever happens is just icing on what they hope will be the eventual cake? Or should there be, you know, a bare minimum conference final expectations, even if Isaiah is not healthy in Cleveland, even NBA final expectations?
Look, none of our friends from Boston who are sober on a regular basis.
I don't know any of those people.
Yeah, believe that the Celtics were a real challenge to Cleveland last year. The way I looked at it, Cleveland was the best team in the conference. I thought that Toronto was better than the Celtics last year.
And if they did believe that, yeah, it was dispelled in the first half of game one of the conference finals.
Yeah. I thought Toronto was better than the Celtics last year, but for their injury issues. And clearly Cleveland kind of seeded the regular season conference the seed to the Celtics by resting guys a ton down the stretch. But I think people now expect that the Celtics should be able to realistically compete with Cleveland for the conference championship. So yeah, I do think that people expect the Celtics to be a conference finalist. And I would say that as we look at it now, I think we would expect that as well. You never know how things are going to play out with injuries. And a lot of what happens with the Celtics will be told by how much do guys like Jason Tatum and even Jaylen Brown, his second year, he's not going to be 21 for a couple of weeks, how those guys develop. But yeah, I think there's every expectation that this should be a conference finalist.
Steve, enjoy your 66 season on the beat. We look forward to the coverage in the Herald.
You're not supposed to abuse your elders, especially when we can, you know, we're larger than you are.
Appreciate it, Steve.
Good to talk to you, Chris.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Tim Bontemps and Steve Bulpet for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.